We've been talking about the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, and you may have heard the CBS report just a couple of minutes ago striking down the voter ID law or significant provisions of the 2013 election reform law, the so-called voter ID law that the General Assembly passed a few years ago. Obviously, a major ruling with significant implications for the state of North Carolina as we head into the general election. Not the only circuit court ruling that's come down in the last couple of days with potential implications for North Carolina. Not directly affecting us, but the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals just upheld the dismissal of an adjunct professor at a community college in Indiana who sued claiming that she was discriminated against for being gay. Challenged that on the basis of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which bans discrimination on the basis of sex. Earlier rulings and Attorney General Loretta Lynch and others had said that extends to sexual orientation as well. The Seventh Circuit Court saying no, it doesn't, but their reasoning behind it is really fascinating. And for that, we are joined by Carborough Mayor Lydia Lavelle, who is joining us for our weekly conversation with the mayors. And we'll get to Carborough stuff in a little while, but the problem is everyone wears so many different hats, and you're the lawyer, so every time you come on the air, it's another court case that we have to talk
about.
And
how many times has this happened? You know, like, oh gosh, another case came down.
Exactly.
Let's read and talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. And there's two today. Like,
right.
It's
right.
Unbelievable. But anyway, the Seventh Circuit's ruling today, which really needs to be paid attention to, because this has got significant implications as well.
Yeah, let me recap it for you and for the listeners. It's one that came out yesterday, and so this morning we were alerted to it and reading about it. Again, it's a circuit court, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, so it's out of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And it deals with, again, this interpretation of Title VII and how it applies to sexual orientation or not. Now, the wording, Title VII, of course, is like the wording in the statute, right?
Mm-hmm.
Unlawful employment practice for an employer to fail or refuse to hire or discharge any individual or otherwise discriminate because of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. So mm-hmm. the question over the years has been, what does sex mean?
Right.
And so historically, there was this kind of, appellate precedent. And historically, there was this case called Price Waterhouse. Mm-hmm. And are you familiar with that case?
This
a little
is the,
bit,
the one from the 80s, right? The 89 or 84?
It's Price Waterhouse was in 1989.
Yep. Okay,
and it was a Supreme Court case. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court held you could bring a Title VII case based on basically a gender nonconforming claim.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, you actually had a straight woman who was not feminine enough. And she was basically was told she wasn't going to be made partner in her accounting firm because she needed to walk more femininely and needed to.
So we'll make you a partner. We're fine with making a woman a partner, but you have to dress the part and look the part and talk the part.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, from the case, it said you need to walk more femininely, talk more femininely, dress more femininely, wear makeup, have her your hairstyle and wear jewelry. I mean, it was,
Wow.
And so the Supreme Court basically said, this type of gender stereotyping constituted discrimination on the basis of sex and mm-hmm. violation of Title VII, sex stereotyping, okay? And so then the question over the years, what's happened is the line has become, you would have straight people bringing these kinds of actions,
mm-hmm.
But you would also have gay people bringing these kinds of actions.
Yeah.
And so the court was being asked to interpret whether it was based on sexual stereotyping, but in some instances, whether the person was gay or not was relevant or not. And
mm-hmm.
the court would sometimes consider it or not. And what has kind of thrown this into a little bit of flux is that last July, the EEOC actually came out with a decision, and the EEOC basically said that Title VII does apply to
mm-hmm.
Sexual orientation. And so, but the EEOC is not it's not a law that's binding on the courts, right?
And it's the current presidential administration too. So the next administration could interpret differently.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Applies in the executive branch.
Right.
And so part of what I liked about this opinion, when I first heard about it, I thought, oh God, what is this? But I think the opinion very much would like to see this resolved, and very much would like to see it resolved along the lines of really Title VII should cover everything.
Yes.
And the opinion really it cites to a few cases in its own circuit, basically saying, look, precedent requires us to dismiss this. Precedent, we have no precedent in the circuit that would allow a Title VII case.
And a reminder of how important precedent is to judges. Even if you want to rule a particular way, if there's no precedent for it, you really can't.
Exactly, and especially in these circuit courts, because they're the intermediate appellate court, and so they can't create new law unless the law's not been created yet. Mm-hmm. But if the law's already there, they have to follow it. So I really like the way that what they say is, we really need to, unfortunately, continue to follow the precedent in our circuit that says sexual orientation is not covered under Title VII. However, they go into this really good description of how it's been so hard over the years to really kind of differentiate gender nonconforming stereotypes from sexual orientation. And they kind of go in, like they talk about, for example, some courts have tried to let me get right here to the case, because this is really good. Let's see. Different courts have gone about this task in different ways, either by disallowing any claim where sexual orientation and gender nonconforming are intertwined. Okay, so in other words, for some courts, and actually some courts wouldn't even allow any gender nonconforming challenges by gays or lesbians.
Right.
Okay. Alternatively, what they do is they try to tease apart the two claims and focus only on the gender stereotype allegations. And so you can kind of imagine how hard that might be, because if they're trying to tease it out, sometimes it's so intertwined in a way that you really can't do that, but yet you still have a legitimate case based on gender nonconforming challenge.
Yeah. Keep going. Sorry.
So they go on to say that some courts really have thrown up their hands at this, at the muddled lines between sexual orientation and gender nonconforming claims, and they simply have disallowed them when they deem a claim to be a bootstrapping of sexual orientation and stereotyping claims. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm looking for right now here is So this line of cases in which the gender nonconforming claim can't be tainted with any hint of a claim that the employer also engaged in sexual orientation discrimination, that leads to some really odd results, right? So, an odd result would be, for instance, non-gay plaintiffs have better claims for gender nonconforming claims than gay people do.
So that's
what they're getting at with that. So there's three major points I see in this case. And so that's the first point, is this huge kind of blurry line between those two and how that needs to be kind of reconciled by the courts.
And we're speaking with Carborough Mayor Lydia LaBelle, and we're talking constitutional law here, statutory interpretation law. We're not even getting into the Constitution just yet, but this is a ruling that came down yesterday from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, a case in Indiana of a professor at Ivy Tech Community College. I had to look this up, but this is the community college in Bloomington. I think it's all across Indiana, but
okay.
We were in Bloomington for the inner city visit, and we went there, and it was this wonderful place.
And
yeah, so that's the college in question. But a professor there who apparently got fired because she was gay filed a lawsuit, and the ruling from the court essentially is just sort of to sum all of that up. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act bans discrimination on the basis of sex. We know from previous cases that sex can cover sort of not just fired for being a woman, but fired for being the wrong kind of woman. That's the Price Waterhouse case, not conforming to gender norms. But does being the wrong kind of woman extend to who you choose to love, who you choose to marry, who you choose to associate with? That's still very much up in the air, and we don't have a definitive ruling from the Supreme Court. So the court ruling here just sort of pushing it up to that level, right?
Yes, and this first point that we're still discussing, it really makes it uncomfortable for the court, because what they're having to do is kind of, what is too effeminate or not effeminate, and how do you attribute it to someone being gay or lesbian versus just, a mannerism of a person who is, quote, straight, and who really cares,
And why are judges making that decision in the first place, right?
So that leads to the second point about the case I want to make, and they do a really good kind of just discussion of how in this day and age, even though the constitutional cases, which we're well aware of, right, you know, starting with Romer and then Lawrence and then Windsor and then Obergefell, even though all of those cases have increasingly given legal protections to LGBT folks, they don't have really any direct bearing on the outcome of litigation under Title VII, but they do inform this legal landscape that courts face this when they are interpreting because of sex. Because really, a lot of the case law that, judges are looking at in this Title VII legislation is pre-Obergefell, pre-Windsor. It's not in a day and age where these kind of claims are now being brought, that could be brought with regularity. And the court here even cites, you know, it's the old get married on Saturday, get fired on Monday.
Yep.
You know, they bring that up. I also like how they bring up, they quote a question that Chief Justice John Roberts brought up in oral argument when Obergefell was being argued. And you might remember he said this. He said, well, if Sue loves Joe and Tom loves Joe, Sue can marry him and Tom can't. And the difference is based upon their different sex. Why isn't this a straightforward question of sexual discrimination? I mean, it's, it really seems to be. It's probably because the courts over time didn't want it to extend to sexual orientation. We're now in this day and age, it seems like it should.
Yeah.
And so that brings me to the third point I want to make from the case. And that is they do a really good analogy in here of the application of Title VII back in the 1960s to when it was being interpreted with regard to race. And there were a lot of times, a number of courts that found that people, that employees that were discriminated against based on their interracial friendships and their other racial associations, that there's a natural leap right then to coverage of people based on their association with another gender. And so the court here kind of says, well, that's a natural, that's the way those were interpreted with regard to race. Why here now with this association with regard to association with someone of the opposite gender, why doesn't it cover folks based on sexual orientation? I actually think that's a really, really strong argument. And so they kind of conclude really by saying, Supreme Court, we need to hear from you. We need for you to address this. Now, one thing I will say is they point out here that they're the only, they're not the outlier here, that any circuit court that has addressed this, albeit much longer ago, has found that sexual orientation is not covered, okay? I think some lower courts, there have been, I think, some lower courts that have tried to find sexual orientation covered under Title VII. But like many of these big issues, often the Supreme Court won't take a case until there's a split in the circuits.
Yep.
And so it might have to wait until we see one come up where there is coverage. And, you know, maybe that'll come from a circuit like the Fourth Circuit or something. And if and when that happens, I think the Supreme Court will need to address it and should address it.
It's fascinating for so many reasons. And I'm thinking about this in the context of the Fourth Circuit ruling earlier today that, I mean, we talked about this last hour, but the ruling today on the voter ID law, where the judges in that particular case, Diana Motz, goes into so much detail on the legislative intent and all of the information and the details and the statistics that legislators asked for in order to make the law that they made and use that to draw conclusions, which were pretty clear, and she spelled them all out about the legislators' intent. In this case, we're interpreting the Civil Rights Act of 1964, in which I think if you go back, and I think we've talked about this before, you go back to 1964, did the legislators in Congress have any intention that this was going to extend to sexual orientation, gender identity, or even gender nonconformity? Probably not, but at a certain level, once they've written it into the law, it's kind of hard not to make that jump. Yeah, it's interesting.
No, it really is. And I think when you and I have talked about this in the past, we've talked about some of the fears around that time were... sex may not have even got included at one time because it was this big fear that, oh my gosh, women might be treated the same as men.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't even anything. So
and there's that story about adding sex to the bill was supposed to be like the poison pill that was going to kill it and it ended up not. Yeah.
Yeah. So they weren't even thinking of you know, folks that are transgender. They were just thinking of men and women back then. So
and the other question too that I had about this, I mean, the Seventh Circuit, I mean, we were talking about this with the Fourth Circuit earlier that it was a really striking ruling because very rarely do you see a circuit court judge calling out a district court judge to the degree that they did today with Thomas Schroeder. Kind of the same question here, except in reverse. How often do you see a circuit court basically demanding a ruling from the Supreme Court to the way that we got here?
This? It's like the court is really here, though, I think, trying to respect the process and trying to respect the mechanism under which laws get changed in the United States, particularly in the federal judiciary, right? And they don't want to do something like we've seen some outlier courts just run amok with creating new law when they really can't, right? So they're respecting the process here of precedent, and that here in our circuit, this is the precedent. There's nothing else anywhere close. But look, here's, you know, three or four really compelling legal arguments, Supreme Court, why you need to take this case or, you know, take it soon or sometime and really need to revisit this because of this day and age that we live in.
Speaking with Carbo, Mayor Lady Delphalum, I got to turn to Carbo issues here in a second because we got to wrap up. But what do you think the impact of this is going to be on us here in North Carolina? We've got the fight about House Bill 2. We've got the dueling lawsuits with the Department of Justice and the state suing each other. Where does this ruling leave all of that?
Yeah, I don't know if it affects it directly, but I really like the way it's written to say that even though we're following precedent here, here are a lot of reasons why this needs to be revisited. Mm-hmm. I think in a way that would really help us, be able to discount or do away with HB 2.
Do you see the Supreme Court at this point, especially considering this ruling saying, which is, I don't know how many pages it is, but it's that many pages of, hey, Supreme Court, you need to do this. Do you see the Supreme Court turning this issue down anymore?
I see them maybe pausing and seeing what happens a little bit in the Fourth Circuit. Now, you know, it'll be a while before we get that decision. I think, is it October, I think I saw, when the trials?
Something like
so
that,
there's
yeah.
So there's some litigation going to be happening here. My sense would be they might still not accept this yet until that one's decided, and especially if that one goes the other way, then whoever appeals in that, it might get accepted because then you have two conflicting
decisions. The split
decisions.
In the circuits, yeah. Right. Does the fact that there are only eight justices right now make a difference?
It doesn't until January.
Okay.
January.
Right.
By the time this comes along, I think we'll have our ninth justice and probably a really good one. So
I'm almost thinking that's optimistic at this point.
I know. I need to. A lot of my friends tell me not to be too optimistic.
Yeah, we're gonna get there, and it's like, well, you know, we really should let the voters decide in 4 years. Who should?
You can't be complacent. We still have a robust election season ahead of us. That's for sure.
I'm speaking with Carbo, Mayor Lydia Lavelle, and again, this is a fascinating case. I want to keep talking about this. But we've got to turn to Carbo issues before we let you go. I know construction's going on in a couple of places in Carbo, and some really cool transportation news coming up in a little bit more than a week.
Yeah.
Too.
So here we are, kind of nearing the end of summer, and you know, we kind of run out of things to say because we haven't met in a few weeks. But a couple of points I wanted to bring up to our listening audience. One is that we're starting. Well, it's really not so much us. I think it's OWASA and DOT. There's going to be some construction going on South Greensboro Street with regard to our South Green project. And so anyone who's traveling in that area over the next, I believe, 2 months might encounter delays. There might be some times when the road's closed. So as much as you can try to have some alternative kind of, at least during like 8 to 5 for sure, alternative means of travel, I think it'll make your drive a little bit easier. So that's one point I wanted to bring up. And the other is, many of us are really, really excited because our long-awaited extension of Triangle Transit to Carbro is going to be taking effect with the August route changes.
Awesome.
And so the first day of August, which I believe is a week from Monday, is when Triangle Transit, I believe it's Route 405, it'll be extended. It's being rerouted slightly so that it'll loop into Carbro. So folks in our area who want to take Triangle Transit to Durham and beyond, perhaps to North Carolina Central, you can take that bus now. Now by picking it up in Carbro rather than on Franklin Street.
Very cool. First of August is this coming Monday, so is it?
Oh, no, I'm so sorry. It's August 7th. It's August 8th.
It is August 8th. Okay,
August
8th. Cool.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's the first week, actually, the students kind of come back for orientation. That's
so
what
a little bit more than a week from now, you'll be able to take Triangle Transit in Carbro. That's got to be exciting.
Yeah, it is. We're all excited about that.
Yeah. All right. I got to let you go, but Carbo Mayor Lydia Lavelle, thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Aaron.